Yeah. This lecture, entitled Israel Jacobson and the Beginning of Reform, is dedicated to the honor and merit of the Zurok family. In the previous lecture, we described how the nascent intellectual movement founded by Moses Mendelssohn began to take root within the Jewish community. Referred to by historians as the Western Haskalah, its adherents stressed the importance of imparting to the new generation a sound secular education together with some modicum of knowledge of the Hebrew language and grammar, as well as Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible. It spread and gained new followers through the efforts of the educators of the Haskalah-based schools, which opened up in Berlin, Frankfurt, Breslau, Dessau, Sisson, and Wolfenbüttel, as well as similar schools that were encouraged by the Austrian government throughout its empire. The ultimate goal of this new system of education was to produce students that, on the one hand, would be accepted within non-Jewish society, a society that was willing to consider the possibility of Jews receiving equal rights, but yet, on the other hand, would remain faithfully attached to the Jewish community. The schools varied, however, in their general approach to education. Some, like the schools of Austria, stressed the old method of repetition and memorization. The German schools, for the most part, in accordance with the Enlightenment's rationalist view of man, stressed the development of the intellectual and verbal skills of their students. In addition, some schools were influenced by the new method of education advocated by Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi, one of the founding fathers of modern education. Pestalozzi, influenced by the writings of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, stressed that a child's innate faculties should be developed in accordance with the student's natural abilities in a loving and emotionally secure environment. And just as an aside, even today we find these different streams within the educational system. All of these various approaches, however, had a common goal, i.e., to produce a new kind of Jew who no longer felt himself to be part of the traditional ghetto-based culture and who no longer felt himself bound by rabbinic dictum. One example of these modern schools was the Samson Free School in Wolfenbüttel. It was originally founded as a cheder, a traditional school where the study of Talmud was stressed. The administration strictly forbade its students from reading German books, and only some 4 or 5 hours a week were devoted to secular studies. It was, unfortunately, underfinanced and was established to teach only the most impoverished of students. Yom Tov Lippmann, or Leopold Zuntz, the founder of Wissenschaft des Judentums, the so-called science of Judaism, the forerunner of the present academic field of Jewish studies, was the son of a learned and pious scholar in central Germany. Zuntz's education began at the age of 5, when his father introduced him to a course of study that eventually included Chumash, 5 books of Moses, Diktuk, Hebrew grammar, Gemara, Talmud, and how to write Yiddish or Judendeutsch. Unfortunately, Zuntz's father passed away before his son had reached the age of 8, and his poor widowed mother was forced to send him away from home to the Samson Free School. Zuntz, with a tinge of bitterness, described the school as often being lice infested and where the boy's physical well-being was severely neglected. Zuntz himself claimed that he did not possess even a single pair of pants or socks in wearable condition. He did receive, however, a thorough Torah education. In the spring of the year 1807, after Zuntz had been there for some four and a half years, a new administration took over in the school. It was headed by Shmuel Meir Ehrenberg, a Moscow, a Jewish secularist, whose life mission was to revolutionize Jewish education. Ehrenberg proceeded to renovate the school, properly clothe the students, and entirely did over the school's curriculum. This all came about, by the way, through the sponsorship of Israel Jacobson, with whom we will soon become acquainted. Under Ehrenberg, Talmud was now only taught a few hours a week. Instead, the bulk of the day was devoted to subjects such as German literature, French language, history, and geography. Later that year, in August, the first confirmation ceremony was conducted at this school. A similar ceremony had been instituted before in 1803 in a modern Jewish school in Dessau. Dessau, by the way, is the birthplace of Moses Mendelssohn. Confirmation, which eventually became a central aspect of Reform Judaism, is a ceremony where the student makes a formal and public profession of his faith. Its origins are Christian and is actually a sacrament in the Catholic and Anglican Church, and is central to many Protestant churches. The ceremony, which Ehrenberg introduced to a school in Wolfenbüttel, began with a public oral catechism. It's a question and answer regarding the faith. As the confirmand first answered questions relating to the faith, similar as done in the church, and then culminated his presentation with a declaration of the Rambam's 13 articles of faith, the 13 animamins, and a recitation of an original Hebrew prayer. The ceremony concluded with a special blessing that was given to the confirmand by the school's headmaster, Shmuel Meir Ehrenberg. By the way, Ehrenberg's first confirmed student was Yom Tov Lipman Suns. Throughout the rest of his life, Ehrenberg kept up a warm and influential relationship with Suns, describing his relationship with the school and his novel educational approach. Ehrenberg once wrote to Zunz, quote, "In my school, I feel I'm in my proper place. I show my students the path Jews must tread if they want to appear better and more respected amongst the nations than heretofore," end quote. Zunz went on from the Samson Free School to graduate from the local high school in Wolfenbüttel, being its first Jewish student, and eventually went on to the University of Berlin, where he received his doctorate. Very different than the child that first entered the school, Zunz left Ehrenberg's modernized school a changed person, no longer sharing the goals and outlook of the traditional Jewish community. Later in his life, Zunz contemplated conversion to Christianity in order to further his career, a path that some of his friends, such as Edvard Ganz, who became a law professor in the University of Berlin, and Heinrich Heine, the famous German poet, took. But Zunz finally decided against it. It seems that by and large, the graduates of these modern schools lost their attachment to Jewish tradition and observance, and at least those amongst them who continued to identify with the Jewish community went on to become the first members of the nascent Reform movement. Now, these educators fomented their revolution not only in their classrooms, but through their writings as well. In the last lecture, we described the Hebrew journal Hama'asef, a similar journal that was devoted to the propagation of the Haskalah, but written in the German language, was entitled Sulamith. First published in Leipzig in 1806, under the editorship of David Frankel and Joseph Wolf, both prominent Maskilim. It continued to be published intermittently until 1840. Unlike Hama'asef, however, the readership of Sulamith seem primarily to have been Jews who are already estranged from the value system of the traditional community, but nonetheless felt the need of finding a sense of belonging and purpose within the larger Jewish community. This, by the way, seems to have been the major motivation of creating a movement for reform as we will soon see. The following is taken from the introduction to the first volume of Sulamith, describing the purpose of the new publication. It is on your first page of your handouts. This is taken from the... This is written by Joseph Wolf, one of the editors, and it's entitled Content, Purpose, and Title of This Journal. And he writes, "Religion is the essential intellectual and moral need of a cultured man. It is the purpose of Sulamith to expose this religion to the brightest light. Sulamith desires to arouse the nation to a respect of religion that is of those truths which alone are worthy of the name religion. It wants to revitalize the urgent need for religious sentiment and concepts, but at the same time it wants to point up the truth that the concepts and commands contained in the Jewish religion are in no wise harmful either to the individual or to society." It seems from this introduction that this publication is addressing the need to provide a new form of Judaism for those who found it difficult to identify with the traditional form. It continues further, it desires to bring the Jewish nation back to its native level of education. It will demonstrate thereby that this education is entirely pure. It seems now the author is addressing those who are already enlightened, but are suspect of the Maskilim's new approach to education and feel that it may be too Jewish. "And our religious concepts and teachings, as long as they have not been disfigured through superstitious additions, would never be an obstacle to any political constitution, but would rather be part of it, and that in those countries where total integration is not taking place, at least brotherly integration is possible." Again, for those who value the importance of being accepted by the non-Jewish community, but found the practice of Judaism a hindrance, the author points out that a purified form of Judaism, one that is less identifiably or ethnically Jewish, can still be maintained. According to the author, such a form of Judaism will not stand in the way for those who desire to be accepted within the greater society. Finally, Sulamith wants to sort out truth from falsehood, reality from illusion, the useful from the corrupt. It wants to enlighten the Jewish nation about itself. It wants to strike the dry and hard rock and bring forth from it a spring of goodness, which will then by its own power flow forth in its pristine clearness and purify the sap of the tree. In no wise do we desire by vain artifices to graft foreign fruit upon this tree, which could not grow by itself. This was written to assuage the feelings of those of conservative leanings, who were suspect of the Maskilim's agenda as not being sufficiently Jewish, but merely a foreign graft on Jewish roots. It continues, "Only in this manner do we believe that we can utilize for the best purposes the happy atmosphere which enlightenment and education have brought to the souls of men and spread blessing and well-being to the whole Jewish nation. Therefore, we issue an invitation to all those who want to take part in the spread of useful truths, in the advancement of general human welfare, in a pleasant and tasteful conversation amongst the readers, and we hope they will participate with fitting contributions to this magazine in a manner adequate to its plan. Every truth, every inquiry, which stems from pure intention, regardless from which pen it comes, will be welcome to Sulamith." Now, part of the Maskilim's agenda was to reform Judaism and delete those practices which they consider to be superstitious or just ununderstandable, such as the many piyutim, difficult poetic passages that were added to davening prayer over time. The Maskilim were also embarrassed at the lack of decorum, which seems to have been quite common within the synagogue, something that would never have been tolerated in a church service. In other words, they wanted to redesign Judaism so it now appeared to be a sister religion to Christianity. Christianity, by the way, was also undergoing a change of direction, at least from a philosophical standpoint. The emphasis on rationality and the intellect, the product of the 18th century Enlightenment, was giving way to what is known as the Romantic movement, a much more personal and sensuous approach to life in general and religion in particular. The Protestant theologian most closely associated with this movement was Friedrich Daniel Ernst Schleiermacher. In Schleiermacher's opinion, personal feelings and emotion, the sense of oneness with God, is the primary essence of religion, with dogmas and actions or rituals as only being secondary. According to Schleiermacher, the goal of religion is Erbauung, or edification, emotionally uplifting enlightenment. It goes without saying that the stress upon rational thought created by the philosophers of the Enlightenment, as well as the stress upon subjective change of mood and inspiration created by the Romantic movement, although both found in some form in traditional Judaism, are far removed from the core focus of classical Judaism, which consists of submission to the divine will as expressed in the Torah, i.e. 1, providing emotional and financial help to the needy, 2, serving Hashem and connecting His presence and principles to all aspects of life, i.e. business, pleasure, family, and 3, the dedication of one's life to intellectual growth through the study of Torah. To give you a taste of the two modes of religious thinking that were popular in Ashkola circles of the time, one rational and the other romantic, I would like to quote to you from a published sermon and an article from Gotthold Salomon, one of the prominent preachers of the nascent Reform movement. First, a sermon that is clearly in the Enlightenment rationalistic mode, similar to the thinking of Mendelssohn and his original circle, here on the first page of paragraph B. Let the educated and the uneducated set forth in 1,000 sophisms that reason has neither the right nor the capability to raise its voice in regard to matters of faith. God Himself taught us otherwise. The essence of our religion is no incomprehensible mystery, but rather a discernible truth. It is an object of reflection. It need not shirk from examination or fear the verdict of reason. Reason is its element. Learn and know. Perceive and examine. Its teachers call out to us. Its greatest truths are to be perceived, grasped, understood. Go ahead and play with the word faith. For us, there is no faith without perception. Play with the word feeling. For us, there is no feeling. For us, feeling without discernment is no certain guide. Assert that there is no religion without reverie. Reverie without understanding fashions dreamers and fanatics. You probably never heard of Russia like that. Notice the critique against the Romantic movement. Feeling, reverie. It would seem that the purpose of this sermon was to highlight the difference between Judaism and the increasingly attractive Romantic movement within Christianity, and to contrast Christianity with its irrational doctrines of the Trinity, a three-part God, and duality of Yeshu, a God who came in human form, with Judaism, whose doctrines are in concordance with human reason. Solomon, in all probability, is speaking to a group who well may have contemplated conversion to Christianity. This sermon was composed in 1819 or 1820, was delivered in 1820. Shortly after the anti-Jewish riots, where Christians throughout Germany accosted Jews, looted Jewish homes and stores, burned down synagogues with the cry, "Hep, hep, down with the Jews." It was in response to those riots, by the way, that one of the sons of Moses Mendelssohn, Abraham, who was only 9 when his father passed away, had his children converted to become members of the Lutheran Church and changed their last name to Bartholdi. Viewing his attachment to the Jewish people as only a burden, he desired to save them from further harassment and pain. He eventually followed suit and became a Christian himself. One of his children, Felix Mendelssohn Bartholdi, went on to achieve great fame as a composer of orchestral music. In contrast to those rationalist sentiments, I would like to now quote from an article in Salamat, written by the same author, Gotthold Salomon, while he was still a teacher in the Askola-based school of Dessau. This is 12 years earlier in the year 1808. In that period of his life, Salomon was clearly influenced by the then popular Romantic movement founded by Schleiermacher and attempted to show that Judaism needed to incorporate within itself the positive elements of this movement. And here's on page 2 on the top, paragraph C. Religion means to us the holy awe and reverence with which the infinite fills us, which surrounds us on all sides, revealed to the eyes but ever hidden from the understanding. It means to us that conviction and that way of thinking, that which the human being expresses his own relation and that of all finite beings to the entire all of creation with which he feels himself closely bound up. Religion means to us a clear surmise of the most holy, the unseen, the incomprehensible, who cannot be grasped, but only experienced, only felt. Therefore, the seed of true religion is in the heart of the earthly creature, inside of him. For visible signs can never proclaim the invisible. We can only feel the infinite, believe and not perceive. And quoting from Exodus 33, man shall not see me and live. Lo yirani odom v'chol. Again, I don't know if you've heard a drusha from that, like that in your shul either. Now, the first successful attempts to introduce reforms in the synagogue service to make it more hospitable for those who were estranged to some degree from their roots and who found the customary davening in the shul too burdensome came as a result of the French Revolution and Napoleonic victories. In 1795, the French forces under its revolutionary government conquered Holland, displacing the royal House of Orange, thus enabling the local populace to create their own version of the French Republic, which they called the Batavian Republic. About a year and a half later, on September 2nd, 1796, the Dutch officially granted emancipation to their Jewish populace, just as the French had previously done some 5 years before. Now, at the time, the Jewish population numbered some 50,000 souls, of which 47,000 were Ashkenazim, whose native language was Judendeutsch, the Western dialect of Yiddish. About half of them lived in Amsterdam, where the community was rigidly controlled by a group of 7 Parnossim, or administrators, who were chosen from a group of the wealthiest taxpayers. In the midst of the opportunity provided by the recently granted freedom to the Jews, and the government's policy of separation between church and state, there arose a group of 21 maskilim, young Jewish intellectuals, who created a rival and independent Jewish community entitled Adas Yeshurun, the Congregation of the Upright. Because of their independence from the main community, Adas Yeshua needed to provide their congregants with all of their traditional religious needs, i.e. their own rabbi, synagogue, slaughtering house, and mikveh. They also provided their congregants with their own cemetery where their dead were to be buried. But unlike the main community, the burial in their cemetery was made after a wait of some 48 hours. This was in keeping with the then current non-Jewish practice of delaying burial in order to ensure that the so-called nifter, the departed, was really dead and not merely comatose or just experiencing a temporary fainting spell. You know, by the way, that's just as an aside, because of this fear, I read in England, they discovered they had wanted, there was a particular cemetery that they had to disinter for some reason, those who were had been buried. They found in the still non-decomposed coffins scratches, which were indicative of people who had woken up who wanted to get out but couldn't. And as a result, they changed in England, at least in this time, they changed the policy that everyone who was buried, there was a slight hole in the coffin, a string was attached to a toe, the big toe, and it was run through the coffin, up out on the ground, and attached to a pole with a little bell. So if he would move, the bell would ring. And they would have someone in the cemetery watching to make sure that the bell. And according to this article, that's the origin of the idea of the midnight watch. And that is the origin of the term saved by the bell. Yeah. Now we'll continue. This delay, which was widely supported by Maskilim throughout Europe, went against the policy of the established Jewish community of Amsterdam, which followed the accepted halakha of immediate burial upon pronouncement of death. This controversy between the traditionalists and the Maskilim regarding immediate burial will be touched upon in greater depth in Mirtz Hashem in a future lecture. Now, since one of the acts of the new Batavian Republic was to create a separation between church and state and grant absolute freedom of religion, as we stated before, the Parnassim of the established community of Amsterdam, who in previous times would have put an end to such an action of defiance, were now powerless to stop them. Membership of this Naya Killa, this new community, as it was soon called, rose to 100 families, most of whom were of limited means. In fact, historians claim that the real motivation of creating this synagogue was to give the poorer members of the community the ability to fully participate and receive kibudim, honors, to which they were not entitled to receive in the established community, or Alta Killa, where the wealthy members received the lion's share of the honors. Although the old community accused Adas Yeshurun of various lapses in their beliefs and observances, and even prohibited intermarriage with them, the secessionists claimed they were absolutely loyal to our quote-unquote, our holy faith. The rabbi of Adas Yeshurun was Aaron Moshe Yitzchak, or Isaac Granbum, originally of Sweden and, according to historians, a convert, a Ger Tzedek, who had previously served as a teacher and rabbinic functionary in the Alta Killa, the old community, and now served the new Killa, the new community, as both the Morad Asra, the rabbi, as well as the official Chazan cantor. Although Granbum did not introduce his changes into the makeup of the Siddur, the traditional prayer book, as was later done by the Reform movement, he did make a number of minor changes or reforms to the traditional service of the Amsterdam community, many of which were eventually adopted by the Reform movement. For the most part, these changes were implemented so that this new Ashkenazic synagogue would conform in its aesthetics and service more closely to the decorum that already existed within the Portuguese synagogue of Amsterdam. These changes, by the way, were fiercely criticized by the Ashkenazic chief rabbi and the Parnosim of the Alta Kila, the established community, who claimed that Hadas Yeshurim had no right to make changes in the customary service, since this was in violation of the principle, Minig Yisrael Torahu. The custom of Israel or its bindings, the Torah itself. Perhaps since Reb Granbum was a convert and originally came from Sweden and had no firm emotional or family ties to the Amsterdam community or its customs, at least on an emotional level, he did not feel himself duty-bound to uphold their customs, especially those that he argued to be either mistaken or no longer in force. In any case, since these were matters that needed a competent rabbinic ruling, seems, at least on the surface, to have been quite a chutzpah for such a person to defy not only the chief rabbi of the city, but almost the universal rabbinic opinion throughout the Ashkenazic world. Now, Granbum was Rav in that Kehillah community for 10 years and passed away in the year 1807. In the following year, in 1808, Napoleon appointed his brother Louis Bonaparte as king of Holland, thereby putting an end to the Batavian Republic. Following the system that Napoleon already set up for the Jews of France, a consistory, a single governing body, was appointed to guide Jewish affairs. Although some of the leadership of the Hadas Yeshurim was appointed to the consistory, it was dominated by the leadership of the Alta Kila, the established community, and they soon voted Hadas Yeshurim out of existence, and with it the reforms that had been instituted there. In that same year, Rabbi Yisrael Granbum, the former Rav's son, wrote a pamphlet entitled Melitz Yosher, justifying his father's reforms. And really through this Melitz Yosher that historians can cull, understand what had actually occurred in that congregation. Although many of the so-called reforms that Rav Granbum instituted seemed quite insignificant, at least in comparison to those that were later instituted by the Reform movement, they reflect the mood and concern of the congregants of Hadas Yeshurim, give us a greater insight into the motivation of its founders. The Melitz Yosher begins with justifying the first so-called reform. The custom of the old Kehillah was that the congregation completed the reading from Tehillim, Psalms, every week, all 150 chapters. Since it took quite a while to recite some 20 to 25 chapters of Psalms each day, the Tehillim was often recited, at least from the vantage point of its critics, in great haste and confusion. Citing the oft-quoted principle as enunciated in the Shulchan Aruch or Achayim, the Siman Aleph, Sif Dalet, chapter 1, this is paragraph 4, Toiv ma'at tachnunim b'kavona maharbois b'loi kavona. Better less supplications recited with a greater concentration than more supplications recited without sufficient concentration. Rav Granbum changed the established custom and instituted the reading of one section of Tehillim, Psalms per day, that could be completed within 30 days instead of only a week. That's the first reform. Now this reasoning was also applied to many of the slichas, which were traditionally said on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur, which were also deleted based upon this principle. Although fewer slichas and piyutim, special liturgical poems, are generally recited today in Orthodox kilas, congregations, and yeshivas, at that time it was a bold innovation, especially as it was done without consultation of other authorities. Those slichas that were recited, however, were recited verse by verse in order that the people say them with the proper kavana, devotion, and understanding. In the Melitz Yosher of Granbum's son, noted that actually Rav Shol, this is a previous and well-regarded chief rabbi of Amsterdam, had tried to implement those very changes in his Kehillah, but was not successful. Now, in order to enhance the decorum of the synagogue, Rav Granbum also instituted that the Avelim, the mourners, say their Kaddish in unison, rather than at their own individual pace, which often results in a cacophony of voices and little kavanah. This is always a problem in shuls. I know Young Israel has it that the people stand together, so at least they could say them together. This is already the policy in the Sephardic congregation in Amsterdam. It is interesting to know that years later, the recitation of the Mourners Kaddish in unison is adopted as a rule by many of the early Reform congregations throughout Germany. Other changes designed to produce greater decorum were perhaps a little more novel, such as mandating that the chazan stand at the bima, the elevated platform in the middle of the shul, synagogue, when leading services, instead of at the omud, the lectern in the front of the orem. This change was made in order to ensure that the entire congregation, not only those that sat in the front, listened to the voice of the chazan and clearly hear his words. He also made a change in the duchening, or birchas kehanim, the priestly blessing that is normally said at musaf on Yom Tov, on the holidays, except for Simchas Torah, but normally it's said on musaf. He switched it to chakras, and he also banned the individual recitation of the various verses that are printed in the siddur that was then customary to recite it during the birchas kehanim. This was also done in order to create greater decorum. The recitation of these verses, by the way, is also generally deleted today in most kehillas and congregations. It is interesting to note that the Birchas Kehanim in general was a hotly debated issue for the early reformers in Germany. Rav Granbaum also limited the number of those called to the Torah on Shabbos to strictly 7, without any hosafos, additional aliyahs, in order to shorten the service. Those who have a family simcha can appreciate the need for granting a suffis. He also prohibited the widespread custom of giving every single member of the congregation a li on Simchas Torah, as he claimed that the drawn out and lengthy process not only added excessive time to the service, which was a tircha de tzibura, a burden on the congregation, but also created an unbecoming atmosphere of levity and frivolity, as many in the congregation used the added time to schmooze, to be engaged in idle conversation, which ultimately diminished their concentration on the day's Torah reading as well as the subsequent musaf prayer. He also eliminated the recitation of yitzris, piyutim, kroivet, zulos, as these extra poetic prayers were composed over the ages, become the standard at that time in most Ashkenazi congregations. The issue of the deletion of the recitation of these prayers eventually became a cause celebre for the Reform movement. Again, it's interesting to know that most Orthodox congregations today no longer say these prayers. By the way, it's a custom of the Kollel here in Detroit, as well as the Yeshiva in Lakewood, to recite the Yotras for the Arba Parshas, Shkolim, Zohar, Porah, this is in Chodesh, as well as Kroivitz on Purim, but not the various piyutim that are printed in the Matzah for Yom Tov. You get a Matzah for Yom Tov, you'll find that there are many added prayers that generally are not said. Now, some of the reforms were a real departure from common custom, such as the abolishment of Chazoras Hashatz, the repetition of the Shmon Asrei by the Chazan. Rav Granbaum argued that most people don't bother listening to the Chazan's repetition. It's too bad you didn't live then. And furthermore, the reason why the repetition was initially instituted is no longer pertinent. The reason the repetition was originally made was in order to enable an amoritz, someone who was unlettered, and otherwise wouldn't have been able to daven on his own, to participate in the davening, the prayer service. So even though he wasn't able to daven himself, by listening carefully to the chazan's recitation of the Shmon Esrei and responding to each bracha with an amen, he would be considered as if he himself had uttered those prayers. But now Rav Granbaum argued that reason is no longer relevant, as everyone today knows how to daven by themselves from a siddur, and therefore there is no longer a need to listen to the Shliach Tzibur. Now, time doesn't allow me to go into further detail why the vast majority of scholars maintain that the Chazoras Hashatz is still appropriate, even today. But suffice it to say, the fact that Rav Granbaum made this bold move on his own and took it upon himself to abolish this almost universal common custom was a real cause for the established congregation of Amsterdam to question his fidelity to the Torah. Rav Granbaum also banned the custom of wearing a kittel on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, as he felt that the robing and disrobing caused too much of a commotion and took away from the synagogue's decorum. Again, this was also imitated by the reformers of the early 19th century. In keeping with Sephardic custom, as practiced by the Portuguese congregation of Amsterdam, the prayers of Kabbalah Shabbos, as well as the entire davening of Shabbos, from Psukah de Zimran on, were said in unison, word by word. I don't know if you've ever davened in a Sephardic congregation. That's how it's really done. In Granbaum's congregation, this lasted even until Tchiyas HaMeisim and Kedusha, which were all said word for word in unison and in one common tone, Nigun. After the recitation of Kedusha, Kadosh, 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 the congregation continued the rest of the Shemon Esrei in silence. So they davened with the Chazan, word for word, so up until, normally in the Sephardic, by Goel Yisroel, and then everyone davened silently. This continued on after Goel Yisroel, the Chazan was still saying it, as well as everyone together, until after Kedusha, then everyone continued on in silence.
So that's how they had the Kedusha, even though they didn't have the repetition.
That's right, that's how they had the Kedusha. When Hallel was recited, he instituted that only the Chazan was allowed to sing it out loud, and even in those parts which the community customarily participated, as Hodel Hashem Ki Tov, or On Hashem Hashiyano, it was only to be said in unison aloud and in one musical tone. All of this again was in order to maintain the decorum and aesthetic sentiment of the westernized congregants of Adas Yeshurim, who desired in the spirit of the Western Haskalah that their service be as decorous as that of a church service. From Granbaum's son's defense of his reforms, it seems that the typical Ashkenazic shul of the time seemed to have been notorious for its loud and raucous manner, somewhat of an embarrassment for those upwardly mobile Jews who are now being exposed to Western society and its culture. Other changes seem to reflect Rav Granbaum's desire to pattern a shul on the Sephardic model. The Portuguese of Amsterdam, the upper class of Amsterdam's Jewry, were highly respected, especially by the Maskilim. The Nusach, the liturgical form for the Bracha for Hallel, was the Sephardi Ligmor es HaHallel, to complete the Hallel, instead of Likros es HaHallel, to recite the Hallel. Hallel was also recited on the first two nights of Pesach in the synagogue, reflecting the Sephardic, not the Ashkenazic custom. The Torah was also lifted up in Adas Yeshurim before Kriyas HaTorah, the recitation of Torah reading, a Sephardic custom. Other changes in the congregation seem to have been born out of the new emancipation of the Jews and their now equal footing with the Gentiles. Rav Granbaum abolished the recitation of Ov HaRachamim, the prayer on Shabbos, which deals with Jewish suffering and their wish for justice and revenge against the enemies of Jewry. Evidently, in the new liberal atmosphere, Maskilim felt that voicing such sentiments was now inappropriate. This change was also eventually incorporated by the Reform movement. In addition, similar to the church service, the rabbi delivered an uplifting, inspiring sermon at Das Yeshurun every Shabbos. This was a departure from the common custom the rabbi only speak twice a year before Yom Kippur and Shabbos Shuvah, before Pesach and Shabbos HaGadol. In addition, at those times the drasha was not a mere sermon, but a pilkel, a halachic discourse often accompanied by a give and take from the audience. In Adas Yeshurun, the congregation was specifically forbidden to interrupt the Rav in the middle of his sermon. The sermon again was adopted by Reform and eventually by the acculturated Orthodox in Germany, a topic of a future lecture. Amir Tzashem. Although the vast majority of changes that Rav Granbaum made were in the sphere of the synagogue service, he implemented one change to touch upon kashrus, and that was the abolishment of the Ashkenazic prohibition of legumes, kidneys, on Pesach, on Passover. It's not just the kidneys is a term which refers not just to legumes, but to rice, corn, maize. Although the prohibition of eating kidneys on Pesach is not a universal minhag custom, as Sephardic Jews do eat kidneys on Pesach, on Passover, Rav Granbaum's ruling seemed to have been motivated by the same Haskalah-driven fervor that eventually abolished much of halacha and traditional Jewish life. He argued this prohibition was too difficult as imposed too much of a burden on the community. It was also no longer made any sense, as the original impetus of the custom was no longer valid. As we will soon see, the issue of kidneys, legumes on Pesach became another area where Reformed Judaism challenged orthodoxy. Now the truth is that Rav Granbaum and his Hadassah Yeshurim justified all of their changes within the halachic framework. Their motivation was to better serve a largely acculturated congregation that no longer felt comfortable in the established synagogue, but still maintained their orthodoxy. Nonetheless, it did embolden and set a precedent for change amongst those that had actually severed themselves in some various degrees from orthodoxy and wished to express their changed belief system through their synagogue service. Although Hadassah Yeshurim's reforms did not last beyond the lifespan of the Batavian Republic, those changes, however, did set a precedent of sorts and laid the groundwork for what later developed into the Reform movement. The one who actually did lay the groundwork, and was considered by historians to be the father of Reform Judaism, was a German Jew by the name of Israel Jacobson. Jacobson was born in the year 1768 into an affluent family in Halberstadt and received a thorough Torah education. In fact, historians claim that in fact he originally considered entering the rabbinate. Jacobson decided, however, to pursue a career in business and industry instead. Jacobson married the daughter of Hertz Samson, the son of Philip Samson, the founder of the Samson School in Wolfenbüttel, of which we spoke previously. Of course, he had established it as a traditional cheder. Hertz Samson was a court Jew for the Duke of Brunswick and was considered to be the official district rabbi of the Weser region of West Central Germany. When Hertz Samson passed away in the year 1795, his son-in-law, Israel Jacobson, inherited his father-in-law's position. Jacobson served the Duke of Brunswick faithfully and went on to amass a great fortune during the French Revolutionary Wars, supplying the various governments of Western Germany with crucial financial aid during this period of political upheaval. Granted full citizenship for himself and his family in the year 1804, at a time in Germany when it was quite rare, Jacobson nevertheless worked tirelessly on behalf of his fellow Jews so that they too would be able to receive the full rights of citizenship. Although Jacobson himself was not an intellectual, nor for that matter had received a formal secular education, nevertheless he viewed himself to be a Maskil, a self-styled disciple of Mendelssohn, and believed firmly in the cause of the modernization of Jewry. Like others of his circle during that period, Jacobson was an advocate of both educational as well as synagogue reforms. He felt that unless the Jews conformed to the educational standards of the greater society and cultivated a more universalistic approach to their religion, they would never be accepted by the greater society and consequently would never be granted equal rights and citizenship. Jacobson also realized, however, that he was fighting an uphill battle. It would be very difficult for him on his own to change the status quo and the power that the rabbis still wielded within their community. This brought him to the conclusion that only through an official governmental decree could the power of the established rabbinate to maintain the status quo be undermined. To that end, in the year 1806, realizing Napoleon was grappling with the problem of integrating the Jews of Alsace into French society, Jacobson wrote Napoleon a letter urging him to take the initiative on behalf of German Jewry and establish, quote, a supreme council, a central body that would govern the affairs of the Jews of Western and Central Europe. Historians claim that it was Jacobson's letter that gave Napoleon the idea of convening his assembly of notables and his Sanhedrin, the topic of the previous lecture. Now, in his own small way, Jacobson already began the process of reform in the year 1801 with the creation of a trade and agricultural school in the small town of Seesen in the Duchy of Brunswick, where he lived. In Jacobson's mind, the school would lead the way and bring Jewry in line with general society. The anti-Semitic literature of the time claimed the Jews were unfit for citizenship as they didn't participate in the state's economy, with the exception of the distinctively Jewish fields of peddling, finance, and usury. Only when Jews became artisans and farmers, they argued, fields from which the general society earned their livelihood, would the Jews be worthy of citizenship. To that end, Jacobson began his trade school for impoverished Jewish youth. What is remarkable is that 2 years after its founding, his institution admitted a few Christian students as well. Another indication of Jacobson's focus and vision. Attached to the school was a prayer room where services were held not only for the school students, but also for the half dozen Jewish family of Seesen as well. Just as the school was revolutionary in its approach, so too Jacobson wished to build the synagogue of the future, one that would set the trend for Jewish religious life in the modern world. Although Jacobson originally planned to make an impressive structure that would rise some 70 or 80 feet in the air, the local authorities denied him permission and he was therefore forced to build a much more modest structure. Nevertheless, the final building, as we will soon read, was topped by a small bell tower. The introduction of a bell on a synagogue, an obvious Christian adaptation, was so revolutionary that historians note that only one Reformed temple in Germany ever attempted to introduce it. In addition, in imitation of a church, Jacobson introduced an organ into a synagogue. Highlighting its uniqueness, Jacobson called his distinctive synagogue a temple, a usage that was adopted by the Reform movement as a whole, as they denied the hope of ever rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem, and viewed their new place of worship as a worthy substitute. We'll soon revisit Jacobson's temple and relive the events of the day of its dedication. Jacobson was finally given the opportunity to fulfill his dream in the aftermath of the signing of the Treaty of Tilsit in 1807, when Western Germany was ceded to the French and Napoleon created the so-called Kingdom of Westphalia under the rulership of his youngest brother, Jerome Bonaparte. After granting full citizenship to all of his subjects in November of that year, thus emancipating the 15,000 Jews of his kingdom, Jerome decided to take the necessary steps to integrate the Jews of his kingdom into the general society. Jacobson, being the most powerful Jew of his kingdom, played a critical role in this undertaking. Gaining the new king's confidence after loaning him a significant amount of money, Jacobson was first given the task of creating an assembly of Jewish notables. These notables were charged with the job of obtaining an exact census of the Jewish population and making sure that the leadership of the various Jewish communities would from now on maintain careful records of their members. They were also required to make sure that Jews would now take on accepted family names, thus enabling them to integrate into the larger society. Finally, they had to make sure that the jurisdiction of the rabbis was solely limited to ritual and not legal matters, in accordance with the Code of Napoleon. After completing their initial task, the deputies of this assembly decided that a special consistory be formed to govern the Jewish affairs of Westphalia on a constant basis, similar to the institution which Napoleon had created. In their report to Jerome, the deputies described that a key function of this proposed consistory was, quote, the task of bringing a number of customs which have crept into Judaism more into line with changed circumstances and the spirit of the times, and to take the necessary steps for this purpose, unquote. The deputies of the assembly also decided that Jacobson, the head of the assembly, was the logical choice to head the consistory and to appoint its other members. Besides for Jacobson, the consistory was made up of three like-minded rabbis and two laymen, both maskilim, modern educators. One of those educators was David Frankel, one of the editors of Sulamith. The consistory, with the support of the Westphalian government behind them, soon began instituting what they called improvements in Jewish life. All religious services throughout Westphalia were to start exactly the same time. A standardized curriculum was to be taught in all of the schools. And all questions regarding Jewish law were to be decided solely by the rabbis of the consistory. The consistory appointed chief rabbis, ordinary rabbis, and rabbinic assistants throughout every district and department within Westphalia, and determined their salaries, which were to be paid through the taxes which would be levied upon the Jewish communities. These rabbis, in turn, were required to send regular reports to the consistory. They were also sent a specific directive consisting of 21 obligations. Amongst them was that they should serve as an example of moral conduct to their respective communities, as if that had been a problem that needed to be addressed. There was also required to deliver edifying sermons and to deliver them, if possible, in the German language, not Judendeutsch or Yiddish. At least twice a year, a text of their sermons was to be sent to the main office for review and approval. In imitation of Christian clergy, they're also expected to visit the sick and the bereaved, a pastoral function that had always been the responsibility of the entire community, not just the rabbinate. They're also required to prevent disturbances from breaking out within their synagogues, and to also prepare the youth for a confirmation ceremony, something that we discussed previously. The rabbis are also expected to conduct all weddings, the guidelines of which were clearly delineated. The wedding was to be held in the synagogue with the chuppah in front of the Oren Kodesh, the Holy Ark. Under no circumstances were weddings allowed to be conducted out of doors, as was the previous custom, where there was fear of boisterous or undignified behavior which might evoke scorn from their Christian neighbors. The rabbi was to open the wedding ceremony with a short German address, making the couple aware of their responsibilities as man and wife. The rabbi was also required to read a brief German wedding certificate, a Trauungsbrief, which replaced the original Aramaic ksuba. And only the rabbi was allowed to say the Sheva Brachos, the seven blessings said under the chuppah. No one else was allowed to share the honor, as was the common custom. This directive was issued in March 15th of 1809. A year and a half later, in September 24th, 1810, a further directive consisting of 44 paragraphs was issued to further ensure dignity and decorum within the synagogue, similar to the atmosphere of a church. In order to minimize congregational participation, only a regular appointed chazan cantor was allowed to conduct services or read from the Torah. Hence, a bar mitzvah buck was not allowed to lane read from the Torah. When the Megillah was to be read, no noise was to be permitted in response to the reading of Haman's name. In order to ensure compliance with the government's demands, only those who took the required family names would be called to the Torah, and they were to be called solely by those names, and those Germanic names. These were only some of the changes. Now, to ensure that these directives would be followed, paragraph 43 stated that complete obedience was expected, so the consistory would not be required to employ, quote, unpleasant measures of force, unquote. Aren't you happy you live here in America? Now, in order to assure compliance with these new guidelines, all services outside of the officially sanctioned synagogues were forbidden. The populace, however, many of whom had no inclination to change long-standing minhagim traditions, made minyanim private prayer sessions in their own homes. In order to stop this divisive practice and therefore ensure the standardization of their reforms, the consistory obtained a governmental decree forbidding such gatherings, punishable with a heavy fine. Nevertheless, those amongst them who were strongly committed still found ways to practice the Judaism of their forefathers without compromise. In Halberstadt, for instance, the greater part of the community arranged a private prayer service with the wealthier members vying with one another for the honor to pay the required penalty. In addition to all of the above, it's difficult dealing with Jews. I mean. In January 18th of 1810, a ruling was issued by the consistory allowing the populace to eat kidneys, legumes, rice, and corn on Pesach, on Passover, similar to dispensation be issued by Rabbi Grambum, it says, in Amsterdam some years earlier. The rabbis of Westphalia were also encouraged by the consistory to comply with this ruling, as any opposition would be regarded as, quote, the action of a man neglectful of his duties and unwilling to prove himself worthy of the consistory's confidence, unquote. This particular ruling was greeted with great outrage, as the rabbis of the French Central Consistory in Paris sent Jacobson an angry letter protesting this decision. At the behest of Jacobson, one of the rabbis of the Westphalian Consistory, Menachem Mendel Steinhardt, wrote a tshuva responsum justifying this action. Needless to say, outside of reform circles, this ruling was rejected by the vast majority of observant Jews. In addition to having created a school in Seesen, in 1809, Jacob also was involved in creating a similar school in Kassel, the capital of Westphalia, his newly found home and base of operations. It started that year with 75 students. In addition, a rabbinic school was opened in Kassel for the training of, quote, genuinely religious, end quote, rabbis and teachers. It opened in 1810 with 5 students. Rav Steinhardt, the one who gave the heter, the permission for the kidneys, gave classes in Gemara and the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. The vision statement of this school, with its aim, was to produce rabbis who possessed a thorough secular education in addition to their rabbinic training. The rabbis are also required to learn homiletics, the art of giving a drush, a sermon, to master the art of presenting their ideas clearly in written form. Although the school's leadership envisioned their graduates being scrupulous in their adherence to halacha, Jewish law, they also desired that the school foster an equally strong commitment in their graduates to the spiritual welfare of the Jewish community. We can all well imagine how these graduates would really have turned out. This dream of theirs never came to fruition, however, as Russia, Prussia, Britain, Sweden, and Austria formed what is known as the Sixth Coalition against Napoleon in the wake of his failed Russian campaign of 1812. Even though Napoleon was initially successful against the combined armies of the coalition, he was eventually overwhelmed by their numerically superior forces in mid-October of 1813 in the so-called Battle of Leipzig, the largest of the Napoleonic battles. Shortly before Napoleon's defeat, in September of 1813, the Kingdom of Westphalia collapsed, as well as the consistory, and thus came to an end all of the changes that Jacobson had implemented during his reign. But of all that Jacobson set out to accomplish during his 5.5-year reign as head of the consistory, his crowning achievement, at least in his own eyes, was a dedication ceremony for his temple in Seesen, which he carefully planned and over which he presided. This ceremony, more than anything else, gives us a clear picture of who Israel Jacobson was, his dreams, and his values. The following is taken from an article written in Sulamith by an eyewitness to the dedication ceremony. And here we have on page 2. And its title, the article, is the Season 1810, Dedication of the Temple of Jacob. The many hundreds of persons who had been invited came from Brunswick, Kassel, Halberstadt, this is Göttingen, Goslar, Helmstadt, and all surrounding places. Most of them had arrived in Season on the previous day, the 16th day of July. Some of them lodged in the ample buildings of the president, Jacobson, and others for whom there was not enough room were put up in the inn, and all costs were borne by Mr. Jacobson. In the evening, he entertained everyone for dinner. On the day of the dedication itself, on the 17th of July, at 7 a.m. in the morning, lovely music resounded from the roof of the temple, which was flat like a platform, and announced to the city the approaching festivities. At 8 o'clock, all who had come to participate in the festivities assembled in the school hall of the well-known educational institution which Mr. Jacobson had founded in Season. One could see persons of distinguished rank, scholars, Jewish, Protestant, and Catholic clergymen, officials, businessmen of all kinds, all walking together in complete concord, and uniform tolerance seemed to permeate all members of this numerous company. Here friends met, acquaintances and comrades from university days who had not seen each other for a long time and found each other unexpectedly here. The manifold and different groups in this large assembly were most interesting. Everyone found something to talk about. At 9 o'clock, the ring of bells announced that the ceremonies would begin. Someone explained in a loud voice how the procession from the hall into the temple would take place and what the celebration itself would consist of. Thereafter, everyone began the solemn processional under the ringing of bells. The procession was led by two flags and by the students of the Jacobson Institute and the teachers. Then followed President Jacobson, the prefect of the Department of Ochre, Mr. Hannenberg, and the clerics and lay members of the Israelite consistory from Kassel. Then came all the rabbis present, walking in pairs in their clerical robes, and the Christian clergymen similarly. The mayor of the town and the deputy mayor came in their robes, the Count of Brabeck, public official of the kingdom who were present, and all of the other invited persons appeared in their best clothes. Finally, there came many other people from all classes and all faiths who had come from the entire surroundings to observe the festivities. In solemn silence, the long procession went from the auditorium of the school into the halls, through the doors, into the street, and again through the doors of another house, through this house, into the court, to the temple. Special admission cards have been printed for this festival in order to preserve order, and that they be distributed amongst all the participants in the procession. After the procession had entered the temple proper, there came from the organ loft lovely music by 60 to 70 musicians and singers, and this put all hearts into the most solemn mood. After everyone had taken his seat, a cantata composed especially for the celebration by Dr. Heinroth, one of the teachers in the Jacobson Institute, was sung splendidly to the accompaniment of the rousing sound of the instruments. Don't you feel bad you weren't there? The Jewish ritual now began, with Mr. Jacobson himself being the chief officiant and the rabbis assisting him. At the end, President Jacobson gave an address, which we print further on in excerpt. After the scrolls of the Torah, which were elaborately ornamented, had been taken from the ark with great ceremony, they were carried around the temple 7 times, preceded by boys with burning wax candles. He really had a good imagination. What?
A church procession.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then several chapters of the Pentateuch, the Torah, were read, first in Hebrew, and at once in German, publicly with a loud voice. Mr. Schott, director of the educational institution, then mounted the rostrum and talked to the assembled multitude. Then came a chorale accompanied by organ and full orchestra, and this was sung first in Hebrew, then also in German. At the end of this song, in the singing of which the Christians and Israelites participated with deep emotion, church counselor Heinemann delivered an address befitting the occasion. After this address, there were further songs by the choir. The temple was richly and tastefully illuminated, its architectural beauty, its decorations and gilded pieces visible on all sides to the eye, the graceful columns and antique chandeliers, the flower garlands which hung everywhere, the colorful mixture of people, all this presented a most beautiful and interesting view. At the end of the service, President Jacobson elaborately entertained at a table of 200 in the school auditorium and adjoining rooms for 70 musicians, other rooms for an additional 100 persons. The students of the Institute ate in the open in the courtyard. The festivities were original and unique. Where would one have seen a similar day on which Jews and Christians celebrated together in a common service in the presence of more than 40 clergymen of both religions and even sat down to eat and rejoice together in intimate company? Now we will quote an excerpt of the dedication address from Israel Jacobson. It has been left to the tolerance of our days to bring about and to make possible that which only a little while ago would have appeared impossible. In building this edifice, it has not been my intent to bring about a complete religious unification of all religions. One accomplishes nothing at all if one desires everything or too much at one time. What is needed is gradual and slow development. As is demonstrated by nature itself when it brings forth its greatest spiritual and physical accomplishments. Any divergence from this wise procedure of our common mother nature, which human stubbornness or frivolity might suggest, would only be followed by failures and even by the very opposite of that which was desired. What I had in mind when I first thought about building this temple was your religious education, my Israelite brothers, your customs, your worship, etc. Be it far from me that I should have any secret intention to undermine the pillars of your faith, to diminish our old, grand, honored principles through the glitter of new opinions, or that, because of some hidden vanity, I should become a traitor to both our religion and you. You know my faithful adherence to the faith of our fathers. I need not protest it. My actions will witness for me more than my words. But if I do seek here some reapproachment between you and our Christian neighbors, I would ask more for your gratitude and honest help than for your criticism or even opposition. For your true and progressive enlightenment depends upon this reapproachment. On it depends the education of your spirit for true religiosity, and at the same time also your future greater political welfare. Who would dare to deny that our service is sickly because of many useless things, and that in part it has degenerated into a thoughtless recitation of prayers and formula, that it kills devotion more than encourages it, and that it limits our religious principles to that fund of knowledge which for centuries has remained in our treasure houses without increase and without ennoblement? On all sides, enlightenment opens up new areas for development. Why should we alone remain behind? Let us be honest, my brothers. Our ritual is still weighed down with religious customs which must be rightfully offensive to reason as well as to our Christian friends. It desecrates the holiness of our religion and dishonors the reasonable man to place too great a value upon such customs. And on the other hand, he is greatly honored if he can increasingly encourage himself and his friends to realize their dispensability. Our ecclesiastical office, the Israelite Consistory, is willing to help us, is greatly concerned with the improvement of our synagogues and schools, spreads more correct principles abroad, and will, without partisanship, do the best for us, even if at the moment we cannot see the flowers or fruits of these efforts. And you, my highly honored other friends, who in name and in some aspects are different from my faith, I hope I have the full agreement of your sympathetic hearts in the principles I have set forth of the intent of this temple building, of the hope for a happier future for my compatriots. There's nothing in this intent that in any way contradicts the principles of pure religion, of the demands of general morality, of reason, or of your own humanitarian attitude. I trust, therefore, that you will be far from receiving my brothers coldly. I trust that you will not reject them as did your forebears only too often, but rather that you will accept them with love into the circle of your society and business, that you will solicitously stretch out your hand to us in that rapprochement which I have sketched in its ideological outline, and for the sake of which partially I have dedicated this temple. Accept therefore my deepest and most devoted thanks for your warm interest in this rare celebration which you have so obviously manifested for me and my friends through your precious presence and through the expression of your sentiments. And thou, O God, whose mighty hand has lifted up our people once again after such long debasement, just as it happened once after long imprisonment, thou, O God, whose goodness has made it possible to complete the work of several years and bring it to a happy ending, grant unto us further, we pray, that we might sense the glorious traces of thy love, of thy benevolence, of thy protection, both in the faith of our compatriots as in the results of this temple building. But with this confidence, let us not be guilty of the indolence of delay, of the embarrassment of indecisiveness, of the mystical hope of the superstitious, and merely hope for thine assistance. May we, conscious of our dignity, never forget man, the high destiny of a being whom thou hast gifted with reason and freedom, who might think for himself, act for himself, and whom thou didst destine not to be a soulless machine in the plan of thy creation. Let us never despair of the good cause of religion to mankind. Let us not lose heart when new obstacles will be thus thrust across our path. When we find that any beginning like the uplifting enlightenment of a dispersed people can proceed but slowly with many difficulties and can mature only after centuries. Above all, O God, make us vividly conscious that we are brothers with all the adherents of other divine teachings. We are descendants of one humanity which adores thee as their common father. We are brothers who must learn love and gentle tolerance. Brothers, finally, who, under thy guidance, walk toward a common goal, and who, in the end, when the mist will have been dispelled from before our eyes, and all the errors gone from our spirit, and all doubts removed from our reason, will meet each other on one and the same road. Amen. Not long after the demise of the consistory, Jacobson left Castle Westphalia and resettled in Berlin, the capital of Prussia. There in his home, he started a private minion that became the model of even greater reforms than that of Westphalia, becoming the inspiration for the Hamburg Temple, the forerunner of the modern Reformed Temple. Just as an aside, it's interesting to note that, like Mendelssohn, the inspiration of the Western Haskalah, the majority of Israel Jacobson's own children did not remain within the fold and became Christian converts. In fact, Jacobson's son, Dr. Hermann Jacobson, one of the leaders of Berlin's Catholic community, dedicated his book of sermons, quote, to the memory of Father Israel Jacobson, president of the former consistory of Westphalia. In his preface, he wrote, "My father's conscious motto was Moses. His unconscious motto was Yeshu. When he began, what he began, I am continuing. This is what I owe my dear father, and that is why I remember him with loyal affection." End quote. The story of the Berlin Reform Minion, the Hamburg Temple, and the rabbinic response to these efforts of reforming the synagogue service will be the subjects of the next lecture. Now, are there any questions? You're asking about what was the dream of Israel Jacobson. Israel Jacobson was a Moskal. It's hard to know what he actually really believed. Hard to know really what he believed. With all of the flowery speech,
right,
he wanted Jews to be accepted by Christians. And he wanted Jews to share a belief that would be not necessarily the same as Christianity, because he wasn't a Christian, but on the other hand, had very little of a distinction between what was Christianity and what Judaism was. The fact is, we see what happened to his children. We see the seeds of what he planted, and the speech itself is really indicative. It's hard to say that anybody who was truly committed to Torah mitzvahs would have ever made such a speech.
But if you're a thinking person under the speech, you see there's so many contradictions.
Yeah, you're asking about what he's contradicting. It is really, this speech is similar. You get a letter or you get a call. It says, "We are from the IRS. We're here to help you." This is really what is it. You know, thou protest too much, as Shakespeare would say. When he's going, say, "I'm not here to make any changes," and you hear this whole speech, evidently he is here to make major changes. He's afraid of all the criticism he's going to receive, and therefore he begins with this thing. "You know how from I am. Do you have any questions?" And therefore he proceeds. The meal, evidently, I would assume, would be very shocked. The meal, he kept kosher, probably kept Shabbos. His wife went to the mikveh. Sure, like everybody else. He learned in yeshiva, and he had learned at the time in yeshiva. But he went off. He would be similar, basically, to Mendelssohn. And he's a person, but he had the power. He wasn't the real intellectual, he wasn't a real philosopher like Mendelssohn. And he had the power and the money to really make the changes that he really wanted.
One of the things you had mentioned in the paragraphs that were edicts that were put out about that the rabbi is supposed to be an upstanding person.
Yeah, you're asking about what he said about the inappropriateness of behavior. What particularly you're asking, what was he referring to? It's really hard to know if he is dealing with an actual problem or that which the anti-Semites had projected. It's really hard to know when he said you should act morally upright. It could be that it's quite possible, and I don't know. This was a period of the beginning of the Haskola. And it was a period where people were going off and really not as committed as they had been. And you could understand a rabbi or a magid or someone getting up and reprimanding them very seriously, and a fight coming out into the, and words being spoken, and the basic thrust was that Jacobson was saying, "We don't want any of this. We want this to be conducted with decorum, and you should be above criticizing your congregants." Yes. Yeah, you're asking about the two sermons he made in About Face.
He did make an About Face.
Did he make an About Face, or was it two different audiences?
Or it could be it's two different audiences. Listen, you know, it's hard to know what this person believed also. They are paid, in other words, these people are paid to produce that which the congregation wants to listen to. That is their... This isn't about it. What I quoted here was not to understand Gotthold Solomon, but to understand the thinking that was behind these two sermons.
In his temple, where did the men and women sit?
You're asking about where they sat in the temple. I'm sure it was separate seating. They probably sat in the balcony, the women. Well, the you're saying about this thing, it really... This was, he's viewed as the father of reform. You know, as they viewed him as really as a model, you know, of reform. Okay. A good to